Hey, y'all. Thanks for staying subscribed through our long hiatus. That is very kind of you, and both Jared and I greatly appreciate it. With that long hiatus noted, I guess there was some rust on our podcasting game, and for some reason we still can't figure out. Jared's audio sounds like he's in a can. Maybe it's because we're talking about demons on this one. Anyway, we've done what we can to raise his volume, but you'll notice pretty quick it's heavily edited. I think you'll find it still very much something you can listen to. I just wanted to give you a heads up here at the beginning. We've got the next episode in the can already, and it's fixed on that one. One more thing, Mac Williams, Cookville Mac on Twitter, pushed us hard to get this episode done. He gets name dropped in the episode, but I'm also going to dedicate this one to him. Thanks, brother. All right, let's get going on Pop Culture Quorum Deo. Hey, 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 Pop Culture Quorum Deo. This is Jeff Wright, back with Jared Moore. It has been a hot minute. We appreciate y'all staying subscribed. When we were on Sound of Sanity, the host said, we weren't sure if you wanted us to promo Pop Culture Quorum Deo because we weren't sure that you were still doing it. But we are, Jared, and we're back. Back to talk about a movie that I'm very enthusiastic about, but I get the sense maybe you're not as enthusiastic about. That'd be Nefarious. Before we get started there, Jared, how you doing, man? It's been a while since our listeners have heard from you.
I'm doing well, man. It's been, I think, a year since we have recorded.
Really? A year?
Yeah, a whole year.
That seems crazy.
You've had, what, two babies since then?
Not two, but almost. Yeah, I've had two within a 3-year period, so yeah. You need to get back on that train, man. It's time for you to catch up.
I'm trying to talk my wife into it, man, but she kind of has to do a lot of work.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. So a year, that's insane. Well, I'm glad we've come back to hit record. We've got a few segments here that I wanted to run through. But before we get into our old school segments, I want to get an update on your book. So you've just turned in a manuscript for a publication, maybe?
I have, on the Lust of the Flesh with Free Grace Press.
And is this your dissertation for a more widespread audience? Is that what this version is?
It is. And, it's the language is kind of summarized more, less academic, but, still has the sources, footnotes, and also added a chapter on the temptation of Jesus, because I think that's, people misunderstand his temptation, they misunderstand Gethsemane, they misunderstand Hebrews 4:15, talks about how he was tempted in every way, like us, except without sin, and people have... They try to use all those things to defend their sin, which is pretty remarkable considering Christ went to the cross, and his going to the cross actually prepares the way for us to have our sins taken away, like his death, burial, and resurrection, ascension. And people don't want to, they're not talking about that to take their sin away. They're talking about his temptations. They're trying to say, I'm like Jesus. When if you read those temptations, and you read Hebrews 4, the whole point is that you're not like Jesus. You're worse than Jesus. We're worse than Jesus. And we need him to take our sin away. We need his righteousness credited to us. And so, but I added a chapter on that because I think it's misunderstood. And it's used to justify sin, which is insane to try to use Jesus to justify our sin.
Hear, hear. I mean, we've talked about this a lot on stuff we've worked on, this podcast, not excluded. Go ahead, crack that thing open. Everybody needs a little sun drop when they're podcasting. We've talked about it, and I've said often, I'm hoping this book comes out. I'm ready for this book to come out. I want this book to come out. I think this is going to be useful to the church. And so every time we get a little update that maybe it's coming a little bit closer, I get excited. I want to see this thing in print. You probably don't have any idea, though, when it might be on a bookshelf, do you?
I think by the end of this year, that's the goal.
Okay.
And so that's what we're aiming for.
All right. Well, that's not exactly the time frame I would hope for, but I'll take it for now. Okay. Well, I guess that's enough intro. Let's jump into what you're watching.
What you watching? What you watching? What you watching?
And so, Jared, what you been watching the last year?
Well, the ones that come to mind are, I would watch The Conjuring with the kids the other night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And they were terrified just right before they went to bed. It's good for them.
Yeah.
And that was just enjoying some James Wan stuff, you know. And they're interested in it now, especially with demonic possession. And it's an opportunity to talk about Roman Catholic superstition. And those movies are so funny. Like, if you know anything about the Bible and demonic possession, and then you see what's typically done in those movies, you're like, where in the world did like 95% of this crap come from, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not the Bible. It's like Roman Catholic superstition, medieval, like...
Extra-biblical content.
Extra-biblical, and the reason why the demon acts like he's hurt by it is to deceive you to continue believing in Roman Catholicism. So it's just, it's wild. I also watched with the kids a movie that I want to recommend called A Bronx Tale.
Oh, yeah.
And that is Robert De Niro. It's a gangster movie, but it's a gangster movie with a positive message. It has bad language in it, but that's a bad language and violence. There's no sexual stuff in it, but it's kind of the, especially watch it with your sons, because basically it's arguing that, you know, crime doesn't pay.
Mm.
The gangster in it is telling a young boy, you know, not to follow my life of crime.
Oh, yeah.
Even though he's working with that boy. And the guy's dad, the boy's dad, is played by Robert De Niro, and he's a bus driver. And he's constantly dragging his kid away from the bar where this gangster's at. And he's telling his kid, look, you know, don't go down that path. You be a working man. Long story short, and I'm going to give it away, spoiler alert, but the gangster ends up dying. But he had murdered somebody at the beginning of the movie. And then the guy's brother comes back by the end of the movie and kills him.
Oh, wow.
And so
his sin found him out.
Yeah. And that it's kind of that. And it's not just that, but the kid's friends that are racist towards the black community, they're driving in that community and they're throwing those cocktails, what they call
Molotov
cocktails. And they break one in the car and essentially kills every one of them.
Oh, gosh.
And the kid was in the car before that happened. And that gangster drug him out of there, stopped the car and got him out of there because he knew they were idiots. And so long story short, it's a cautionary tale to a young man to basically not be like the gangster, not be like the stupid teenagers, but to be like his father, which is essentially the argument of the movie.
Yeah, that's great.
It is good. And Robert De Niro, he's once a good guy in a gangster movie, you know?
Yeah, for sure. That's rare enough.
But it's worth watching. Watch with your sons because, you know, young men are stupid often.
Like, yeah.
We have a tendency, there's stereotypes for a reason. The reason why car insurance is so high for teenage boys, right? Jeff, right. You are the reason why. You are the reason why I rode with Jeff and kissed the ground numerous times whenever I got out of the vehicle.
Whatever. This is slander.
Oh, my goodness.
This is false. Fake news. You, sir, are fake news.
No.
I handle a car like a surgeon handles a scalpel.
This is true. Ever since you were 16 years of age, that's true. I still, for the record, I still kiss the ground once I ride with Jeff today.
Oh, that's unfortunate that you would lie like that in front of all these people. Yeah, okay, so I want to redirect here.
I got another one.
Oh, well, before we move on.
Sure.
Your kids are a little bit older than mine.
Yes.
So how old are the kids that are watching The Conjuring with you?
The youngest was 8. However, I wouldn't recommend.
My wife would lose her mind if I tried to take one of our 8-year-olds in to watch The Conjuring.
Or Amber... So the next night, like he went to bed, because it's a long movie.
Uh-huh.
He went to bed, and the next night I'm putting it on, and Amber's like, you don't need to watch this with Judah, because it scares him to death, and he don't even want to go to the bathroom downstairs that's adjacent to the living room, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
Because it is a scary movie.
It's a very scary movie.
But you and I have kind of been desensitized to the horror genre,
yeah.
And we just watched so much of it that... But it is a scary movie, and I think it's good to be scared. But Ian can handle it, the 10-year-old, but the 8-year-old probably needed to calm down on.
Well, my family, at least on my mom's side, has this long record of, like, even before my mother's older and we live way out in the country. They can remember when they first got a TV, and basically all they could get on television was Vanderbilt football and pro wrestling. And like, people would come from all over the community to watch pro wrestling on this one TV. So I mean, I'm talking about living memory when TV wasn't part of their life. But that whole side of the family has always had an interest in the supernatural, ghost stories, and things like that.
Cool.
And it gets passed down. That's where I got it. My kids have it. Christy does not. And so she's the break on this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
She's kept me from kind of running ahead, sometimes in a way that I'm like, I'll just honor you. You know, I think maybe you're not right, but I'll honor you in case you are. And it's not costing us not to watch a certain movie at a certain age. But I have done something similar with my kids. That's why I was checking. So my oldest is 14. My next is right at 12. And we watched Cujo.
Mm.
And we watched the 1989 Pet Sematary.
Both of those are scary.
Yeah, pretty scary. And not surprisingly, you know, the dog stuff didn't really terrify my older kids. I let my 9-year-old watch it too, Cujo. But Pet Sematary got into my two oldest kids' heads a little bit, particularly Zelda.
Interesting.
Yeah, Zelda as that...
cat, right?
No, Zelda is the older sister. She kind of gets forgotten. She's the wife's older sister who dies of cancer.
Oh, yeah.
But you see her body kind of distorted and whatnot. And so I've always thought that was kind of maybe the most frightening part of that movie. And it was just funny to see my kids respond, too. You know, they were super eager to watch it, came home and asked if they could watch something by Stephen King. These are the two that came to my mind. And yeah, it was surprising to me that it was the body horror of Zelda that actually stuck with them. So all that was about me wondering how old your kids are when you're showing them The Conjuring. I think our listeners might be interested in that too. What were you wanting to talk about?
Another movie we watched was A Man Called Otto with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And that's worth watching. They have to do a trans lecture in it.
But, oh, great.
Yeah. Other than that.
So brave.
And they do make light of suicide somewhat, but essentially it's about a man whose wife has died. He's retired or forced retired from his work. And so he doesn't feel like he has any purpose or value anymore. And so he's going to kill himself.
Hmm.
And there's this annoying neighbor, pregnant lady, that essentially annoys him and befriends him and gives him value again. And so it's kind of a lecture on the importance of community, the importance of neighbors, you know, and so it's worth watching. And of course, Tom Hanks is excellent in it.
Yeah.
And it makes I've got guys like this guy in my church that are, you know, if they weren't Christians, they'd be exactly like him. They're very, yeah. You do too. I know guys in your church, they're the same way. They're very good at their jobs. Like, they're very meticulous and, you know, and when that would be taken away from them, if they weren't believers, it would really rock them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so these neighbors help show him that he is more valuable than those two things, more than his marriage and just his, vocation. And so I would recommend that to watch, but of course there's a trans lecture in it that is, I just get to where I laugh at these things because it's utter stupidity. I got an email the other day from somebody at Tennessee Tech because my son is wanting to do a summer camp through engineering there, and you stay overnight. And the person who emailed me has pronouns in her bio. And I'm about to reply back and be like, why do you have pronouns in your bio?
And why would I trust my kid to someone who has pronouns in their bio?
Yes.
I mean, what do you think we're going to do? I mean, there may be a whole group of people out there in groomer land in the public school system or something where you could harvest kids from. But you're reaching out to people who are sane. And as soon as you have that nonsense in your bio, you're telling me I'd be better off sending my kid down the street in the van with no windows that's got free candy painted on the side. And there's no telling what you'll do with him, you know. That stuff, that just makes me so aggravated.
It's so stupid, and these are supposed to be academic institutions.
Right.
They're dumber than a box of rocks.
Right.
You ain't got no common sense.
It's not even just dumb. It's morally insane.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to, you know, that's the thing you'd also want to say to someone like that. You don't have to do this. You know, maybe there's some kind of mandate from HR. Just don't do it and see what they do.
Yeah.
Try to fight. I mean, I know it's your job. I know it's your career. But at some point, somebody who's sane has to say, I'm not going to run off the cliff with y'all, and make them have to respond to someone who's saying something reasonable rather than the training groomer society, you know. My wife watched a man named Otto, or called Otto or whatever, and really liked it. She loves Tom Hanks movies. Mm-hmm. And we'd watched one that Apple had done. I can't remember what it's called, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't realize it had released. Basically, he's this post-apocalyptic scientist who's built a robot for a companion, and they're trying to make it across the country so they can preserve the life of a dog. And, you know, Tom Hanks is always going to hit at least a triple. So mm-hmm. it's just rare you come away disappointed. I'll probably check out Otto, too. Anything else you're watching?
There is one more thing. I've been listening to Lore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've listened to almost every episode of the podcast Lore. And I just wanted to briefly say about their latest episodes on Christianity. The dude had the nerve, Aaron Mankey, had the nerve to, talking about Europe, he said that more women during the witch trials in Europe were killed than men. And why do you think that is, Jeff?
Witches or women?
Well, no, it's the patriarchy.
Oh, of course.
The patriarchy, no, chauvinism. But he also noted that in Russia, during the same time period, that more male witches were killed than women witches.
I object to the idea of male witches. Warlocks. I want to call them warlocks.
Warlocks. Yeah. So why do you think that is?
Probably also the patriarchy.
Yes.
Oh.
The patriarchy in both instances, historically, was the reason why more men were killed in Russia
and more women
in Europe.
Yeah.
And so it just, so lore, Aaron is basically creating new lore.
Yeah, that's right.
And when he tries to make an argument, like I listen to lore for the stories, not for the lectures. I mean, come on. And he's the president of his company. Why isn't a woman the president? What's he doing?
It must be the patriarchy.
It is the patriarchy.
It's the patriarchy.
Like, practice what you preach, dude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Give your position to a woman.
Yes.
Anyway,
it's golly.
Ticks me off because you've got such a good thing going, and then you ruin it with stupid, illogical.
I mean, that's the story of media creation for the last 4 years. I mean, that's going to be the epitaph on Disney's tombstone. You had such a good thing going, and you ruin it with all this stupidity. And it can't come fast enough. You know, let Disney die. But I really, that's our last kind of need at this point, is for a lot of these people to cut their own throat, basically, as content creators. And everybody else view them as a cautionary tale and say, I think I'll just make normal stuff. And stop the scolding, stop the lecturing, stop pushing people into insanity, and kind of hit a reset button. So let that come on. I'm happy for this to accelerate till we get to that point.
What have you been watching?
Well, that's a thing, man. I've been kind of in trouble. I'm going back and watching old stuff. But because of this exact factor, there's very little I'm enthusiastic about. There's a lot I'll put on and watch. And then I'll turn off. You know, it's just not worth my time. So I was thinking this year, I have been enthusiastic about the movie Megan, the Super Mario Brothers movie that just came out, and the one we're talking about today. So you know, we're 5 months in, and there's been three movies that I care to say anything about. They're not, you know, even the bad movies aren't interesting enough to comment on. If you look at the Oscar nominations this year, It's rinse and repeat, woke nonsense. These movies that are supposed to be important because of they're telling the same kind of cultural oppression story that's been told a million different times. I'm just not going to spend any more time on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in kind of a dearth.
I'll put a bug in your ear. A new Mission Impossible is coming out in a couple months.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, whatever Tom Cruise is making, I'm probably going to be interested in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Maverick was one of the best movies that's come out in a couple of years because it was just a movie.
Yep.
And the Mission Impossible franchise is pretty consistently delivered. So I'll definitely watch that. I wanted to watch The Pope's Exorcist. I saw enough of it to be like, oh, this is just garbage. I've got some friend of the show, Mac Williams, wants to watch the new Evil Dead. So I watched the first remake, Evil Dead, from a couple years ago, or maybe it's more than a couple. It's just atrocious. It's just kind of torture, porny,
yeah,
you know, nastiness. I'm just
I'm not going to waste my time on that, you know? And so I may go to hang out with Mac, but if it's just me putting a movie on, not happening. So I'm in a bit of a rough spot with those things. I did ramp up podcast listening. You know, I'm doing much more of that. It was some of my chores and whatnot. And you made a comment earlier I want to circle back to. So you talked about The Conjuring as sort of propaganda to make people think, basically for demons to make people think the Catholic Church is credible and there's superstition. So there's a podcast out now called The Exorcist Files. Are you familiar with this? Mm-hmm. It's from iHeartRadio or some big production studio. So it is a auditory experience. Like if you have nice headphones or nice sound system, they do lots of different stuff to make the room feel immersive and whatnot. But this guy's a long-standing exorcist, and these are supposed to be from his case files. And so he goes through these different cases he's worked. But that's really been what I've concluded basically from the series, is that the reason that his work as an exorcist carries any significance is either because God is just gracious to people through his church, even if they're corrupt. So the guy may have helped someone, you know, find deliverance at some point. But most of what he talks about, I really do believe, is a long con where the demons act like it's messing with them, so people will keep going to Catholics. Mm-hmm. He tells a story of encountering this demon who claimed to be a demon who possessed one of the knights who went and killed Thomas Becket on behalf of, is it King Henry that broke the Anglican Church away from the Catholic Church? It's kind of a famous story. You know, Becket's this priest who's standing in the way of Henry getting the divorce he wants so he can have a male child with another woman, you know. So he, in the offhanded way, he says, well, no one rid me of that troublesome priest. Some of his knights here, and they run kill Thomas Becket. Okay. Well, this demon, according to this priest guy, claims to be the demon who possessed the guy who killed Thomas Becket. So his strategy is, another thing about this priest that the files come from, he's a relic collector. He's known as the relic guy. He has this, you know, insane private collection of holy relics, which, you know, as I'm hearing all this, I'm like, oh, okay, here we go, you know, Papist nonsense. So the way he really sticks it to this demon is he goes and gets one of his relics that's stained with the blood of Thomas Becket, and he brings it in, and he sticks it to the possessed person's flesh, and the demon howls in agony. And I'm like, yep, this is theater. This is theater to prop up superstition to keep people thinking that spiritual power is at play here. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, I don't deny that maybe the guy, just Christ in infinite mercy, helped someone get delivered from him. But his methodology and the theology it's built on is Papist nonsense. And
he's still reading scripture publicly in front of the demon and stuff. And still, yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like there's still
legitimate spiritual contact with Christ.
There's some in there.
Yeah. So
perhaps, you know, that is legitimately harming, but like you said, there's so much essential evil there and a dependence upon the authority of the Roman Catholic Church to deliver the demon. I mean, the holy orders is the only reason a priest can do it and not somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. He's got the holy orders, which is sacramental from the
authority bishop of
the Roman Catholic Church.
Yep. Yeah, so it's interesting storytelling. And even some of the ways that he alleges people become demon possessed, that probably is how, you know, there's a guy who's willing to trade his soul for physical strength because he wants to be impressive in that way. And you just hear some of this stuff that, yeah, maybe there's something to that. But at the end of the day, you come away, if you understand the Bible, you understand the goodness of what God did in the Protestant Reformation, you realize that this is demonic in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll put a bow there on what you're watching, and we don't really have much for So Sorry to Interrupt, but I did want to put a bug in our listeners' ears and yours. I was recently part of a group that released the statement on Christian nationalism in the gospel. Mm-hmm. It's a strange time politically, and I think people are trying to think through what the faith looks like applied to civic society. In a fresh way. You know, this has been the case for me. I'm basically a Ron Paul libertarian up until around COVID and George Floyd, realized classical liberalism is not doing anything to restrain the nonsense that's flooding our society. So I took a fresh look Anyway, if listeners are interested, I don't expect them all to sign up for Christian nationalism. I know that's a scary term. But if they want to look at statement on ChristianNationalism.com, they can find it there and read it. Would love to hear from anybody who had anything they wanted to offer on that. And a mutual friend of ours named Ben Woodring and I have started a podcast called Backwoods Belief, where we realized basically the institutions have betrayed us. These groups that we thought would be helpful leaders or forces that would kind of move the ball forward for Christ in their day under his providence have decided to betray the church. And so we're trying to cast a vision for people to say, you know what, it's okay to be on the margins as a believer. It's okay to be out of the mainstream. Christianity is going to do just fine out there if that's where the Lord's providence is. And so two things that if listeners are interested and willing, I'd love for them to check out. And if they have any thoughts, good, bad, or otherwise, love to hear from that.
Oh yeah, brother, I think that's good. We've talked some about Christian nationalism, but I don't see what other direction you go. You know, if you believe the Bible should have more influence than any other book in America, then you're a type of Christian nationalist. And if you lock your door tonight, you're a type of nationalist. Like there's just, you're trying to protect what's yours, and there's no different in locking the border than there is locking right. your door at night.
Like right.
you're making a statement about, you know, protecting your citizens, and you're talking about protecting your household. Mm-hmm. I don't see. Anyway, I'm glad that y'all wrote that, and I'm looking forward to reading it and, you know, considering the claims and the arguments.
Well, what you just described is how I ended up being associated with it. You know, the bad guys in culture use Christian nationalism as a boogeyman term to chase any sane person who doesn't want to just rush headlong over a moral cliff. And so I really think about it. When January 6th went down a couple of years ago and everybody was like, oh, Christian nationalism, I legitimately don't believe Christian nationalism existed as a significant political movement. But you eventually get called something long enough, you may go look it up. And when you start realizing like, well, yeah, I kind of do want the U.S. to act in its own self-interest. I think that's reasonable for a nation to do. And I think that the moral and intellectual framework of Christianity is the best way for a nation to know what's in its best interests. You end up a Christian nationalist pretty quick. And if you're not scared by the term, which, you know, it's never a wise idea to let your enemies determine what terms you can use or apply to yourself, right? So if you're not scared of the term, well, all of a sudden it starts looking much more profitable than what we have going right now. So,
you know, everybody's a nationalist in America. If you don't believe me, then watch what happened when Greg Abbott, I believe that's his name, governor
Texas.
Of Texas, and DeSantis, when they take a busload of illegal immigrants and they take them to Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, yeah.
And you watch those people become
Martha's Vineyard lists.
Yeah. They're nationalists for Martha's Vineyard.
Whatever their community is. Yeah, that's
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And everybody is like that. Those who are arguing for open borders. Let me go dump them on your porch and let's see you care for these folks. Now, we believe in legal immigration precisely because imagine if you lived on the southern border and think of trying to work your job. Like, you've got all these people in Hollywood arguing this stuff. Illegals aren't coming across the border and taking Hollywood acting jobs.
Right.
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 Like, they're not coming and taking politicians' jobs.
Right.
They're taking jobs from American citizens, which we need to care for people.
Strengthening our infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, all that it entails. So our neighbor is the illegal, but it's also American citizen. And the Bible is similar to your household.
Well, and also, Jared, just on that point, you cannot meaningfully care for your neighbor if you're caring for every neighbor at the same time.
Absolutely.
We are not, you know, the world is made where the resources grow, but it is still not a world of infinite resources. Mm-hmm. And certainly this country isn't a country of infinite resources. And so to love your neighbor in any meaningful sense, I mean, you have to have a plan and a scope. And so these arguments that a Russell Moore just kind of brainlessly trot out about Jesus was an immigrant, you know, anybody who's lived in the real world for 10 minutes knows I can't care for everyone who lives in my zip code. Or if I try to, I'll end up caring for none of them. Stretch that out bigger areas. And to actually love your neighbor, you've got to figure out how to use your resources wisely. So, I mean, this is probably longer than I meant when I plugged that, but those are the kind of thoughts that led to the statement on Christian nationalism. Everybody out there listening to this isn't going to be a Christian nationalist.
Right.
They're going to find stuff in the statement they disagree with. But I do think it's a position that should be at the table, should be part of the conversation.
Well, if there's things that, you know, listener, if you're, if there are things you can disagree with, hit Jeff up.
Absolutely.
And because they're still kind of in the end stages of, you know, finally formatting mm-hmm. that statement. And so you could still possibly affect or clarification or just reach out to Jeff.
That's certainly true. We're trying to dial it in right now. So, again, statement on ChristianNationalism.com, Backwoods Belief, if you got your podcast app and can subscribe. Love to hear your thoughts. So, Jared, let's get into it, man. You want to talk about 2023's Nefarious?
Absolutely.
You went to see this because I and the aforementioned Mac Williams nagged you to death about it.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm not thanking you for taking forever to do it. Mac somehow ended up mad at me like I was the one dragging my feet.
I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, it's because you're a liar. You lied about my driving. You lied about my driving. Now you're lying about recording a podcast, Jared. I don't think I know who you are anymore morally, pal.
Not true.
So anyway, I heard about this through Steve Dace. He's a conservative commentator, I think, on the Blaze Network. He was heavily involved in the movie. I mean, I guess he's kind of the guy who mostly got this thing done. And I went to see it because stuff you've already talked about. We like horror movies. It's a possession movie. I think that's a genre that's ripe for Christian storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard Dace talking about wanting to kind of raise the bar with Christian storytelling. So I was glad to go throw a few shekels in the coffers over that. And again, as I've already mentioned, also, I was very pleasantly surprised. And I'll tell you a story on air. I may have shared this with you privately, but as we're recording, it was me and Mac watching the movie. And there was a group of teenagers. I couldn't tell if they were like university students or high school age, but I don't think they were there as part of a youth group event. They had come in to watch a horror movie. And it was basically six of us in the whole theater. It was Sunday night, you know, late showing and not well attended. And when it was over, as we were filing out, that group stayed in their seats and was talking about the movie. And, you know, I couldn't linger very long without becoming creepy, but I could tell that they had wanted to come to see a scary movie and they'd had a moral vision put in front of them that they did not expect. They weren't being derogatory. They were just kind of talking through a moral framework. That's my term. That's not how they would describe it. But things like the demon celebrating abortion and some of that stuff that I was pleasantly... I was pleased to hear them having that conversation after the movie. So anyway, that was my experience. And I'm hoping that there'll be a lot of groups like those who kind of just show up for a scary movie
mm-hmm.
and see something that it's not a gospel movie, but maybe it will do some pre-evangelism work.
Sure.
Yeah. So let's jump into the questions here. Jared, what's the story of Nefarious?
A demon possesses a man and... not an innocent man, but a man who tilted himself towards demonic possession. And then he addresses an atheist, essentially bending an atheist towards his will. In just a sadistic, deceptive way, kind of, you're going to do what I want you to do, and you're going to want to do it. Similar to how, on a positive note, it's similar to how God orchestrates
His will,
like with the crucifixion of Christ, like, you know, the devil basically entering Judas ended up being his undoing. You know, he had to hand over the keys and because Christ took care of the sin of the church.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, listener, I'm assuming at this point, if you're still listening, you're not worried about spoilers or you've seen it, but this would be a spoiler territory moment. The setup is... three people, basically. And, you know, that's one of the conversations I've had on the far side of it. This could be a play pretty easily. You need three actors. You have the demon-possessed convict. You have, and listener, he's on death row. He's getting ready to be executed. And then you have the atheist psychologist who's there to evaluate if he's mentally competent or if he's an insane person. Basically, should we morally execute him? Or should we say he's incapable of knowing what he's done and treat him as a mental health care patient? And you got a warden who shows up every now and then to kind of push the timing and say, we got to decide if we're going to fry this guy or not. And the thing I've told some of my students, and I believe this, you may push back on it, but I think it's a morally perfect universe. I don't really have criticisms whatsoever of the framing of the movie. It acknowledges demons exist. It acknowledges evil exists. It acknowledges that, you know, demons and evil are fundamentally reactive creatures in rebellion against God, who's the ultimate good. And I think it gets a lot of the specifics of life in a fallen world and our cultural moment right. And so we'll talk about some of that more here in just a minute. But that's the reason when I tell people I'm enthusiastic about this movie, it's because it's a bulletproof moral universe. And I think they get a lot of the details right after that. I'm pretty enthusiastic about that. And I can't remember, you know, outside of a movie like Facing the Giants or something, you don't get something that's as dialed in as this morally. But I also find this movie much more interesting than something like Facing the Giants. So anything you want to say beyond that, or we want to get into the next couple questions?
The only thing I didn't agree with was I felt like it was trying to say something about either the death penalty or the electric chair, or I just don't understand the choice to make the most graphic scene the frying of this guy who was, the demon said, was totally innocent of the crimes that he'd been accused of.
Yeah, well, let's save that for distorted evil and false, because that may be where we'll have some different views on that. Where are you at in the movie?
I guess I'm supposed to be the atheist, but I mean, I was an unbeliever at one point. I don't think I was ever an atheist, but just the self-righteousness or thinking I'm a pretty good person type thing kind of resonated with.
Yeah.
I'd hoped he'd be a believer by the end, and I think that was a poor choice on their part. But.
Yeah. So he's kind of he's the fixture of interest. I don't know if he's the audience's point of view character, but you definitely are experiencing the story through him, mm-hmm. for sure. Yeah. Well, so what's good and true and awesome in this movie? You want to take a lead on that? I've got several things written down.
Yeah, I think that the emphasis on that there is an unseen realm, an invisible realm, if you will, that is the source of all that is evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Bible seems...
Well, the source, it's at least a co-conspirator. Like, there's evil that arises from within me, but me and that unseen realm are in this co-conspiracy against God, who is everything good, right?
Yeah, but even how the Bible portrays... The way the Bible portrays our goodness is that it's from God. And the same way the Bible portrays our evilness is that it's from the devil. Like, when Jesus refers to the Pharisees, you know, your father... You're of your father, the devil. As far as they know, they've never had any contact like with the devil, but he's talking about their hearts. Like,
yeah, he says their converts are twice the sons of hell that they are.
Yeah, and so...
I guess my concern there is not to limit man's culpability. You know, the devil made me do it.
Yeah.
It's kind of where I'm balking. But I get what you're saying. There's a father of lies, an initial tempter, mm-hmm. things like that.
Yeah, it's both and. Like, it is of the devil. We do the things that we do because of the devil, while also being culpable for what we do. It's like the Garden of Eden, where God, you know, punishes the devil, and then he punishes Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
Like, punishes all three of them.
Yeah.
But he says, because you've done this to the devil, and then he, you know, lays out, you know, they're all culpable. We're all culpable. And so they seem to take culpability away from the man who's demon-possessed, and I don't think culpability can be removed from him totally.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, the other thing that I did agree with, we're talking about good, true, and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I agreed with the going after abortion. I agreed with the source of evil, the ultimate source of evil. Not being God, but being the evil one. And then it's good that they say abortion is murder, because that's what it is. It's evil, murder. And then they also go after assisted suicide, which mm-hmm. I thought was very good, very well done. Because that's what you're going to see a lot of. If assisted suicide is legit, you're going to see a lot of children who are wanting an inheritance quicker have their parents and encourage them to have their lives taken. And let's just be frank. The reason why the government in Canada is trying to encourage assisted suicide is so they don't have to pay for those citizens.
Who aren't contributing to the tax base and right. things like that.
That's 100% why. Yeah. And our government will do the same thing.
Yeah.
Like they can say, we want to help people, we want to help people. But the truth is, if you're, it's much cheaper to have you dead than it is to keep you alive.
Right. If you're a Darwinian individual, and Darwinian is one of the regnant ideas in the spirit of this age, there's a place where you stop being productive. I mean, it's where you start to see Darwinism and Marxism line up, right? Your value is basically only what you can produce, what you can contribute. And once you're past doing that in a way that we recognize as a valuable contribution, I'm not saying older people don't make valuable contributions, but Darwinian people don't have any idea how to evaluate that.
Right.
They want to get them gone.
Your dignity is your ability. Your dignity right. is not intrinsic to who you are as a human being.
Right. It's your function. I mean, this is like stuff that Peter, I think it was Singer, who was at Princeton as an ethicist, was saying years ago. Mm-hmm. Even with people who aren't going to get an inheritance, just to have the burden of an aging parent and the kind of grossness that comes with aging, whatnot, off their shoulders. Yeah. Hey, mom, dad. Let's get you taken care of. It's time to shuffle off this mortal coil. And it's gruesome, but this movie gets it right. That's what we're doing. It's for selfish ends.
Absolutely. And the demons seem to indicate that they were tempting him towards that, like they were encouraging him to kill, have his mother killed.
Yeah.
And he's culpable. Like, I think that is very good. I'm glad that movies are saying this, like, because Hollywood is... You know, in Canada right now, the government's putting out advertisements to try to make suicide beautiful, like euthanasia beautiful.
Insane. It's absolutely insane.
Like, go look those up, listener. If you haven't looked them up, do a search and find those ads.
Yeah, yeah. Canada is a dystopian nightmare. So, you're resonating with the things that I loved about this movie, too, and what makes me so enthusiastic about it. I thought the acting was pretty strong. You know, it's not the best acted thing I've ever seen.
Right.
But the guy who played Nefarious, it was kind of channeling. You could clearly tell he'd watched Heath Ledger's Joker, you know. and so it's not the most unique performance, but he did a good job of being this distinct character when the demon turned the reins back over to the core personality. And then being this other person when he's the demon. I thought that was well done. But the dialogue is really where my enthusiasm comes. You know, you talked about the assisted suicide. I think maybe one of the strongest scenes in the movie, and the one that I think about the most, is where the demon is able to anticipate that the atheist dude's girlfriend is about to have an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And he just stands up to exult in the death of a baby. It's one of the most unique scenes I've seen in a movie because nobody is going to talk about abortion as demonic celebration, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty pronounced and pretty powerful. But there were lots of little details that I thought were pretty wonderful, too. So, you know, at one point, they bring in a religious man. I think he's supposed to be a Catholic priest.
Yes.
And the guy's a liberal. And when he thinks he's a man of authentic faith, the demon is on his guard. He doesn't want anything to do with him. But once he realizes he's a liberal, well, he's quite happy to have him. And, you know, sees him almost as like a partner, which is accurate. And finally just sends him away, kind of making fun of him. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a wonderful detail to add.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly how Satan, as the father of lies, uses those kind of religious liars. I also liked, because I'm a C.S. Lewis fan, I liked how petty the devil was. So he's involved in these high-level conspiracy acts of evil, right? The whole thrust of the movie is the demon basically wants to release a piece of propaganda through this psychologist. So that's his big setup, you know, set up this stage for the Antichrist to step out on, in some sense. That's what he wants to do at the highest level. But he's also taking pains to help get that baby aborted and get that mother suicided. But then also, again, to the pettiness, he's happy to deny the desired last meal of the guy he's possessing.
My kids talked about that
yep.
for hours,
yeah.
days later.
Yep.
I was so I felt so bad for him not getting his meal.
Yep.
And I thought out of all the things in that movie, they remembered that the most.
Well, I think the reason I think that's powerful is it shows you how corrupt the devil is. It's not just the high level stuff. It's the pettiness. He's that morally defiled. There's a scene in Lewis's Paralandra where the unman who's possessed by Satan is the opponent of the good guy. And at night, the person that they're both trying to act on, they're trying to keep this otherworldly Eve from falling the way our Eve fell. She's asleep. They can't do anything. And so at night, the devil, because he can't do anything worse, spends his time torturing frogs and keeping the good guy from getting a good night's sleep. And I always thought it was a brilliant storytelling move because, again, it shows you the pettiness of the devil. He's willing to do whatever he can, right down to denying a guy a final meal.
He hates us.
Yeah, he hates us. And will do anything that he can to create misery. And this is sort of for a lark. It's not equivalent to these other things. But because this comes from a political commentator on the conservative side of the spectrum, it just stood out to me. At the end of the movie, you find out that the demon has survived. And the way you find out the demon has survived is because the protagonist encounters the demon in another victim, another host, right? And there, at the very end, he's possessing a homeless black woman who's rummaging through the trash. And I remember at the end of the movie being like, the number of people who'd be willing to make a woman a demon-possessed person, a black woman a demon-possessed person, a homeless black woman a demon-possessed person, all that hits all the identity politics markers, right? How dare you dehumanize the homeless, and you think all black people are, you know, demon-possessed and all that stuff. I just thought, there just aren't movies that would make that choice. And I kind of appreciated the way that they were like unconcerned about identity politics at the end. I'm not celebrating or championing making homeless people demon possession victims, but I just thought it was interesting that this movie does not care about the cultural fashions of our day pretty much at all. And I appreciated that.
Neither does Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, that's true too. That's true too. So, Jared, what's distorted evil and false here?
Again, I think the death penalty thing is something I want to talk about. It acted like the man who's demon possessed was not morally culpable for anything that the demon did through him. Only the demon that the man was culpable for leading up to the possession, like for letting the demon in, I guess. But then after that, he's evidently not culpable for any of the murders, any of the things that he's been accused of doing. And I just don't think that's biblical, the way the Bible portrays demonic possession. And even though individuals take over, like demons take over individuals, it seems that the person's will is in line with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to push back a little from within the storytelling. So one of the things I appreciated about the movie is that it basically set up the idea that demons are groomers. And that they keep, you know, we've talked about this, I think, on this podcast, that they, you know, if the Bible's picture of demons is accurate, and it is, they have to function as something like an intelligence community where they share details and information and they have schemes, right? You know, that's probably at the higher levels, but there's probably some that are like just orcs that are kind of beastly and uncontrollable, but somebody out there is sharing information. Mm-hmm. Well, in this one, Nefarious tells the protagonist, yeah, we groomed this guy into being the kind of person who we could get someone to, you know, a demon to possess. And then they show that they've done the same thing to the psychologist, that he has been groomed, right? We go into his cell room and we see that there's like a dossier on him and there's pictures of him as a kid and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they have groomed both of them. But I also think by doing that, it tells us that this guy is culpable because, I mean, you and I would agree, a guy who pushes his girlfriend to have a pregnancy aborted is worthy of death in a biblical moral framework. A guy who's dishonoring his father and mother to the degree that he'd push his mother to commit suicide is worthy of death, right? And so if Nefarious's plot in the movie had worked and this guy became demon-possessed, he's certainly culpable of everything that would be brought on him from that. And without them saying it explicitly, I think that's what they're telling you about this other person, Billy or whatever his name is. We don't get all that detail, but because we're shown that both of them were groomed, I do think the movie suggests that this guy went along with the temptation. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to feel sorry for him. He's gotten much worse than he bargained for. And clearly he's not on board with everything that's happening. But I think there's room in the story itself to say they're not just saying he's completely innocent.
I thought the choice to make the death scene in the electric chair so graphic was an odd choice, considering their other arguments, because explicitly they're saying abortion's evil,
yeah,
assisted suicide is evil, and then they, what's the third thing? Like you think of the three arguments he made, that the demon yeah. made.
No, this is a great point.
The third one was that this guy's not culpable. Like,
yeah.
They're trying.
The psychologist has sent an innocent person to the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but I mean,
that's a great counterpoint.
It could just be that the demon's wrong. Like,
whatever the guy did wasn't worthy of the death penalty. Right. The demon took him further. You know, that's there. But that's a, you know, clearly he went to the chair as a murder victim, according to the framework of the movie.
Right. As a murder victim. And then they made it so graphic, yeah. I think, to emphasize his innocence, like how heinous this was.
Yeah, and again, that's a storytelling. I'm going to say there's a storytelling plus, because you remember the warden says, we never use the electric chair anymore unless someone opts into it.
Oh, okay.
And the demon had picked it rather than a quicker death, because he wanted to torture that guy. It's kind of like a worse version of the getting rid of the final meal.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, my kids didn't talk. I told them to turn their head during the.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
I was surprised at how rough that was.
Yeah.
Also, the statements the demon made about free will, he basically argued for a libertarian free will, which is the power of contrary choice, which is what Arminians teach, which doesn't exist.
And it's, you know, I talked about that podcast about the Roman Catholic priest and Exorcist Files. It's right out of their theology. Like, that guy repeats that all the time. We had to have free will, otherwise God couldn't know if we actually loved him or whatever. It's like all that nonsense. Same exact thing you hear in that exorcism podcast. So I'm with you. That's as impressed as I was with the writing and the theology.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the theology of the movie is dialed in tight, but this is where it gets weak. It gets weak in the soteriology and the anthropology.
Yes, yes. So basically no one has libertarian free will. Not God, not anyone. Rather, we have freedom of inclination. We act according to our natures. If you argue that we have to have free will in order for love to exist, like libertarian free will, the power to choose otherwise, you have to argue that God in eternity past, the three persons among the Trinity, had to have the ability to choose to not love one another.
Right.
In order to truly love one another.
Right.
Which is, in other words, they had to have the ability to sin.
The Son could have hated the Spirit.
Yes.
And the Father could have hated the Son. Yeah, exactly.
Which is, I think it's blasphemy to even suggest that.
Yeah.
But obviously, God is the very definition of love. And so, if his framework, if he truly loves, then obviously libertarian free will is not essential for love to exist. Not to mention our loved ones in heaven, who are perfect, we believe they perfectly love God, yet we believe they cannot choose to not love God.
Mm-hmm.
They can't choose otherwise.
The elect angels.
Elect angels?
Yeah, right.
Same way.
Right.
Like, it's just, when you start comparing this to God, when you start comparing this in the incarnation, God the Son incarnate, God the Son, through his humanity, cannot choose to hate God. He cannot choose, like, that's not even a possibility, because of the divine person is always the one who is acting through his human nature. You know, Jesus is God the Son. And so just as God the Son could not fail, God the Son incarnate cannot fail, because they're the same person. They have two distinct natures. And so libertarian freedom is a myth. It is maybe the biggest fiction about this movie.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because, again, God doesn't have libertarian freedom. We don't have libertarian freedom. We always act according to what we most want to do.
And we don't want to, we wouldn't want him to have libertarian free will. We wouldn't want that kind of world. That kind of world would be a horror beyond imagination.
It's like the horror movies that you watch that are where left is right, upside down, because that's what it would be.
Mm-hmm.
If God can choose otherwise than his nature, then I don't think we survive.
Like, sure.
I mean, it's only, the only reason we're saved is because God has chosen to fixate his love upon us, to pour out his love upon us. And I don't think he chooses that, you know, if he can choose contrary to his nature.
Well, and again, the benefits we receive in God's mercy and grace are an overflow of the superabundance of love that exists within the triune Godhead. And so it is rooted in God's essential nature, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He has chosen to show us favor, but it flows from who he is as a creature, like you've said, that's not, doesn't possess libertarian free will, which is weird to say because God is the ultimate reality. It's not like he's lacking something that we've conceptualized.
Right.
But as you kind of do an anthropomorphic language, you're trying to talk about this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that one and then one other element I'll bring up here in a minute, if you don't, are the two just kind of like, gosh, man, you were batting 1,000, you know, and you really missed it here.
That was the only thing. What's the other one you're bringing up?
It frustrated me that at the end of the movie, Glenn Beck is sort of the voice of, I mean, honestly, like Christianity. You know, it would be one thing for him to be there as a talking head political commentator who's just doing a book interview, right? But the psychologist is talking through his, what we think is going to be his conversion experience. Mm-hmm. This has disrupted his atheistic framework. He's starting to reevaluate certain presumptions he had about ultimate reality. And he tells Glenn Beck, I'm not there yet. I'm not a Christian yet. And Glenn Beck tells him, well, you'll get there. As if Glenn Beck has the standing to speak on behalf of the Christian faith.
Right.
I don't want to beat up on Glenn Beck. He's done a bunch of stuff that I'm really thankful for, but he's a Mormon.
Right.
And it's just morally inappropriate to position him there as the arbiter of what the Christian faith is or is not going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if everybody will even know that. You know, I think a lot of the audience that's going to come to this because Steve Dace is involved is going to. But those kids in the theater probably didn't know that. I knew it. And I thought that was just a bad choice. Mm-hmm. Now, Steve Dace and his working relationship, you know, he had a Catholic on one of his podcasts that I listened to talking about the movie. So he's probably much more ecumenical than I am. I get why he makes these choices when I consider him as a discrete individual. I just think it's inappropriate for a Christian
mm-hmm.
to make a choice like that. And I wish if it had been Steve Dace, I'd feel completely different than the fact that it was Glenn Beck.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. All right, anything else that's distorted, evil, and false here? No? Okay. Well, let's move into how does the gospel apply, Jerry?
Well, I would hope that they had an opportunity to present the explicit gospel. I mean, you could even have, they talk about it, the demon talks about it a little bit.
The carpenter.
Yeah, the carpenter. But you could have had the demon go after Christians or go after, you know, you could present the gospel in a backhanded way.
Sure, as he's criticizing it.
Yeah. And I wish they had done that. I wish the atheist had been a believer by the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, this is an explicit Christian movie in many ways.
Yeah.
Like, why not? And it doesn't have to be cheesy like a lot of the Christian movies we see. But this guy, if he's not going to become a Christian after that experience, like, what in the world are...
Yeah.
You know, like...
Well, and that was one of the thoughts I had, actually. I had that thought at that scene because I thought, well, I don't know if they're trying to say this, but they are indicating that it's not merely intellectual or experiential when it comes to being converted, because this dude has every reason in the world at this point to convert, and he's not done it. Mm-hmm. How else do you explain that apart from human rebellion, you know, or human stubbornness?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I go back and forth, man. You'll hear these explicit conversion scenes as a criticism of Christian movies. Like, Christians won't consider it a Christian movie unless somebody prays a sinner's prayer. And I get it. Like, I want that guy to be converted too. The other side of this is, we talk about how a good story reflects the real story. And this is a snippet of a real story in the sense that someone can have a crisis in their life that pushes them towards conversion. But in the snippet you're looking at, they haven't quite gone all the way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's like Jordan Peterson by the end of the movie.
Lord willing. Like. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I guess I don't hate it. You know, I would, when he's pulling the trigger and it's not working after he said, God help me. If you don't convert, I don't know what you're doing. Right. Particularly not if you spent this time with a demon. Particularly not if you've had to come face to face with the moral responsibility you have over your mom and your girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So I want all that. But I'm also, I guess I'm happy with what I mentioned earlier, this being sort of a pre-evangelism movie to try to lock in a credible narrative in a moral universe that shows a pattern of someone who is, you know, if salvation involves five steps in the sense of your experience of how it plays out. You become aware of your sin and you begin to look for someone who can deliver you from it. And you start to consider the moral ramifications of what you've done. If we're looking at a story that's on step three or step four, I'm okay with that, you know, and I'll leave up to my imagination what the rest of the story looks like.
Gotcha.
There, apparently that book that they're talking about at the end of the movie is a real book that Beck and them are selling. And I think I'm going to try to pick it up and see what it says. Maybe the story gets continued there. I just thought it was a prop, but Mac or somebody was like, no, that's actually a book you can get.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if the Gospels stated in that. I wonder who wrote it.
Right. And see, that's the that's my curiosity too, because a gospel that includes Glenn Beck, I don't think is an authentic gospel. Mm-hmm. And I want to see where they go because I'm so impressed with the rest of the writing. And listener, if you would do me a favor on this, I've been trying to kind of get Dace's attention on Twitter saying, could you get me in contact with the writers because I'd like to interview them. And so if a listener's hearing this, if you're willing to get on Twitter, tag Steve Dace, tag Pop Culture Quorum Deo, tag me, and just say, we'd love to hear the writers of Nefarious talk to Jeff Wright on this podcast. I ended up getting invited by a friend to go on a podcast to talk about the SBC. And it was a four-person podcast, and there was this young lady who was one of the participants. And when she said who she was, well, it was Steve Dace's daughter. I was like, hey, I love Nefarious, could, you know, and she's supposed to be working those back channel stuff, maybe help me get to do that. But any of our listeners who would kind of help Steve see it on social media, that couldn't hurt. Because I'd love to ask them these kind of questions. What faith traditions are informing your understanding of Christianity? What are your theological backgrounds? I want to know all that.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the gospel's better because kind of the hero of the movie, he stops the devil's plans. Mm-hmm. And essentially what Christ has done, you know, he has stopped the devil's plans. The devil planned to kill the carpenter.
And, yeah.
Ended up being his undoing.
Yeah, I even love that in the writing. They're like, you know, they basically admit we didn't know what we were doing. It was our death sentence, you know.
Yeah.
So we've got to just kind of try to prolong this phase of existence because now we realize we're undone. I thought that was good.
So they're essentially a defeated kingdom, if you will, lurking about, trying to take as many folks down as they can. And they're still trying to overturn what, you know, Christ has conquered them.
Yep.
And he is still Lord over them.
Yep.
But they're still believe, they've still got hope that they can. I mean, I think all that's legit. Like the people wonder why the devil doesn't just give up, or mm-hmm. like he really thinks he's going to win. Like the,
or he's you know, trying to buy as much time as he can. You yeah. know, he's trying to string it out as long as he can. It's one or the other, right? He either thinks he's going to pull off the comeback victory, or he's like, I just want to keep the game going as long as I can. It's like baseball. I just hope we don't run out of innings. Mm-hmm. Which again, I think goes to the strength of the movie. It understands kind of the universe and the options that are available in the real one.
So the demon wrote a book, and then the man changed the book and published it anyways.
Yeah.
And so kind of usurping the devil's plans, which, you know, I think that's a bit naive. Like to think that you could stop the Antichrist's plans, like where there's evil, good men should fight, right? But I don't know. I think that was a bit of naivety from the story. You got an atheist who's the hero, and he's still an unbeliever at the end. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I guess I hold out hope that there's a small-scale version out there where a government school teacher has a student come and say, I think I was born the wrong gender, and that person has enough access to common grace, maybe cultural Christianity, to say, no, it's good that you're a girl. Right. Absolutely, and yeah. and stops the Antichrists and the devil's plans there. I mean, I do hope for some of that.
Amen.
When I think about the gospel here, I'm struck again by how powerful the gospel is. You have this sophisticated, fallen, demonic, powerful entity. And Jesus undid everything using them. Right. And, you know, I think his name was Billy. But if the guy who was possessed, at any point he had his own faculties, If he'd have said, "Save me, Christ," he would have been saved. And Nefarious would have been driven out. This atheist, these wicked things that the movie takes pains to establish that he's done. We know how this story ends. If he repents and believes, he's morally pure. He's forgiven. You know, even of something as atrocious as an aborted child, a murdered mother. I'm not saying that there aren't real world consequences for that, but he's accounted righteous before the Holy One because Christ is that powerful. His blood is that sufficient. And so again, this is going beyond what the movie itself says, but the movie gave me a fresh chance to say, man, look at how glorious Christ is. Look how glorious what he's done is. Look how glorious the power of the gospel is. I was thankful for that.
Amen.
All right, man. Well, anything else you got to say about Nefarious before we put a bow on this?
No, that's it. Hopefully they'll do more movies in similar vein.
Yeah, I would hope so, too. I hope so, too. All right. Well, hopefully it won't be a year before we press record again. Have you seen the Super Mario Brothers movie?
No, I have not.
Go watch that sometime. I'd like to talk to you about that one. I think it's well worth it. Where can people find you out there on the interwebs, Jared?
You can find me on Twitter at Jared H. Moore. And hit me up on there. Follow me on there. You can find me on my YouTube channel at Dr. Jared Moore. And I produce videos. I also have another podcast called All Truth is God's Truth that I'm trying to get going. And go check that out. Go subscribe. And mainly some of my preaching on there, but also deal with like contemporary examples of errant theology and compare and contrast them with Scripture and how to think rightly on particular issues.
Yeah, do go check that out, listener. I'm at Merely J. Wright on Twitter. Most anything I'm doing can be found there. Anything I'm doing beyond Twitter will show up on servantsandheralds.com at some point. So you can check me out there. All right, Jared. Well, I'm going to put a bow on this one. Friends, thank you for, after a long wait, pressing play on this episode of the Pop Culture Coram Deo podcast. For Dr. Jared Moore, I'm Jeff Wright, reminding you to live every moment as if you are before the face of God.
Because you are.
We'll talk to y'all next time.